Welcome back, everyone, to the Authentic as Fuck podcast. Today, my guest is Jay Klaus. Jay is the founder and creator of Creator Science, a media company supporting professional creators. With more than 60,000 newsletter subscribers, 2 million podcast downloads, and 4 million views on YouTube, Creator Science is the leading voice in the creator economy. In 2023, Jay was named Content Entrepreneur of the Year by The Tilt, and the Creator Science podcast was a 2022 Signal Award winner. Previously, Jay's community Unreal Collective was acquired by Pat Flynn and Smart Passive Income. There, he went on to design Smart Passive Income's paid membership community and cohort-based programs. Welcome, Jay. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you again.
Awesome. So, like I was saying before, what we like to do in this podcast is kind of, you know, really dig into a entrepreneur and creator's story to see, like, what are the things that happen in their life to make them who they are today, why they do what they do today, and, you know, like, what's particular about how they do it, right? So, yeah, let's kind of start with you. Is there anything else you wanted to add to that intro, or if you have anything to plug? Let's do that.
It wouldn't be authentic for me to plug things too hard, but if you guys like what you hear, check out the Creator Science podcast. But I just hope that in this conversation, I can share some good stories and help you guys feel more comfortable in your own content, and hopefully keep you or put you on the path.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm excited because I've seen you, like, in the past few years, like, you're just, like, growing like crazy, and it's just, like, so really exciting when I see somebody, like, in the middle of it all, like, kind of seeing what they're doing and, like, and seeing the result of it, and it's, like, because it's rare, right? So, yeah, let's start with kind of your childhood. Like, you want to kind of start with, like, how you grew up, what did you want to be when you grew up, you know, that whole story,
I never remember, like, my earliest memory of thinking about what I want to do when I grow up was playing video games, actually. I was really into this game called Medal of Honor Allied Assault, and I would play it online on PC. But growing up, we didn't have cable. We had, like, a really slow dial-up connection. We lived out in the country. So, like, I tried to do the online competitions and playing in that way, but I was so bad. People hated playing with me because I would literally, like, lag across the screen, which was, like, kind of an advantage in some ways. But this was my introduction to online community, actually. I was 11, 12 years old in an online forum, which, as someone who's about to have a kid, I wouldn't want an 11 or 12 year old kid in the forums the way that I was, but that's just the way it was. But I was modifying the character and the maps, and it taught me a lot about the internet and culture. Then I got really into sports games on GameCube at the time. I was playing a lot of, like, NCAA football. And I just thought that'd be so cool to design video games, but I had no idea how to get there. And, you know, computer engineering wasn't something that I had a model for. Of people doing. So when I went to college, I went undecided and discovered entrepreneurship along the way, discovered, like, what computer engineering and computer science was, worked with a lot of engineers. But that's my earliest memory of what I want to be when I grow up. I thought I wanted to build video games. Fast forward, I got into tech. I worked with a lot of people that were doing development, but ultimately found myself in the content creator world.
How did you first get into entrepreneurship? Because, like, when I talk to people, some people, like, are like, oh, they're like, I'm going to probably work 9 to 5 for the rest of my life, right? And then there's some people who starts out that with that mentality and the shifts over, be like, oh, maybe I can start a business. And then there's some people that are, like, right out of the gate, they already know that they're going to be an entrepreneur. Like, at which point did you realize, and what was it that made you realize, like, maybe I can go into entrepreneurship?
Well, I didn't have, like, the lemonade stand story that a lot of people do. Like, when I was a kid, I was doing lemonade stands and selling candy on the playground. And I don't have any cool story like that. In hindsight, I can remember thinking back. We had these competitions at school that were like fundraisers for the school. It was like, they called it candy and meat sales. And they would send the kids with these catalogs home to their parents and be like, try to sell as much candy or meat as you can. And that raises stuff for the funding for the school. Yeah, meat, like sausage. I grew up in the Midwest. So it was like candy and sausage. And it was like, this raises money for the school, and the people who sell the most get prizes. And the prizes were like trinkets and garbage and whatever. But there was this kid in my class named Cody who won every time. And I remember asking, like, how does he win every time? How does he get all these sales? And the answer was, his parents owned a business and they asked their employees to purchase things. So like, in hindsight, that was actually probably my first introduction to entrepreneurship and like the leverage that comes with it. Because he also had like this crazy house, and his parents always had the nicest things for him. And I remember being like jealous of that, but not understanding how he achieved that. So my first real introduction to entrepreneurship was in college. I was in an honors dorm my freshman year, and I shared a common wall with these two guys who had started businesses in high school. And I didn't have class on Thursdays or Fridays. And so I was just like getting drunk in their room because they're the only two that like could deal with me. Everyone else was studying. It was an honors dorm. They're the only two that would like put up with me. And I was just pitching app ideas. And at one point they're like, hey, by the way, we're in this entrepreneurship organization. That one idea you had was pretty good. You should pitch that at their pitch competition. And I was just like, I don't know what the word pitch means. What's a pitch competition? What is entrepreneurship? But they showed me this world, and it just blew my mind. I couldn't believe that these two guys had like built their own thing, made their own money. They were making their own path for themselves. I had no idea that was an option. And so that kind of led me down the rabbit hole.
So it was kind of like you were in that environment of like,
yes,
kind of like that movie Social Network, like where yes. people were trying to make build apps and things like that. And that's kind of how you got into that world.
Yeah. And these weren't like crazy businesses. Like the one had a landscaping company. He lived in a suburb and he like would do his neighbor's landscaping. The other one was building websites because he could do like WordPress. But like to me, this was just mind blowing. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, got it. So did you, first of all, so you must have been a good student.
Like yes.
you were in the honors dorm. And so yeah. You were a pretty good student, and like kind of when you went to college, you were like, okay, I'm going to try this entrepreneur thing. And then what happened?
I was a good student. School came easy to me. I graduated high school, top of my class, and I got a scholarship to go to college. The only reason I went to the honors dorm was because the newest dorm on campus that had the nicest bathrooms was an honors dorm, and I wanted to be in that dorm. That dorm was full. So they said, let's just put you in the other honors dorm, which is the least renovated dorm on campus. But I didn't know what I wanted to do when I got there. I just knew that college I went to, Ohio State, was big enough that I could, whatever I figured out that I wanted to do, I could do it there. But I was so fortunate that in my freshman year, I stumbled across this university organization, like the student club around entrepreneurship, because that literally paved the way for the next 4 years of my life and really everything that I've done since.
That's awesome. And so what happened next after that? Like, did you go into like a corporate world? Did you get a job or did you start a business right away? What was?
Well, through college, I spent a lot of time with that club and I organized events for the club. I organized startup weekend events here locally. Those were like 72-hour weekend long. It was an international organization that like showed people how to build a startup over the course of a weekend. Mm-hmm. And so I participated in that. I organized those events. I led the club, the entrepreneurship club, my senior year of college. And so I just started building this reputation around town, around Columbus, as like one of the up and coming entrepreneurial kids, like one of the up and coming startup guys.
Like ever since you were 9 years old and you were on that online gaming forums and all that, right? Between then and this time, like, were you always kind of like a community type of person? Like, you know, were you always like organizing events and part of your personality?
In hindsight, yes. I didn't realize, I didn't have the terminology for that at the time, but I was always like organizing parties and meetups and groups, and people tended to organize themselves around me, I guess is another way to put it. Like people, I just kind of like attracted people. And much less so as I've gotten older, I've been like much more introverted and kind of closed off even. But growing up, yeah, I was very much building community without realizing that I was doing it.
That's always so interesting to me because like I see the same thing, right? Like I was watching this movie about Beanie Babies and yeah. how this guy actually didn't want a community. Like he was trying to sue the Beanie Baby yes. communities, right? Like, but these communities started arising by themselves and it was almost so organic. It was like, it wasn't forced. And something, so it was kind of like that was happening around you. You were like this guy somehow yeah, cultivating these communities around you.
I think I was always good at pulling people together that like to have fun. Like we're attracted to enthusiasm is kind of what I've come to understand as I get older. Like we just like being around people who give a shit about something. Like if you're enthusiastic about something, that's just fun energy to be around. It doesn't even matter what it is a lot of the times. But like if you care about something and it's not just like getting blackout drunk, that's so interesting to people because it like it awakens part of us to say like, oh, we have more like agency and control over our lives. We can do things that just we want to do. And I was always attracted to those people. I brought them into my orbit. I connected them together. Magical things happen when you connect multiple people like that together. So it was just always fun to be around. We were always doing different stuff, things that were different than most people. And it was just an energy that I think people are attracted to.
Was there a moment where when you realized that, like about the whole energy and how this is what people are attracted to, this is what grows communities?
I've gotten that language as I've gotten older, but in some ways I'm like speaking this out loud to you right now, like thinking in hindsight. I'm kind of like diagnosing why things happened, okay. why things worked. Like I have realized now it's core to content creation. Like creating content is a transfer of emotion, in my opinion. Sometimes it's positive, sometimes that's negative. But when you have enthusiasm, even negative enthusiasm, you know, call it passion, I guess. But when you have like strong emotion coming out of you, people are drawn to that for one reason or another. And I think that's just what I was surrounding myself with.
Yeah. Yeah, I can always feel it, even on on screen. People also say that too, right? Like if you're making videos, yeah. people always say something about your personality or something like that you didn't even notice. And you're like, what?
Totally.
So it sounds like you've kind of like, you had this kind of community, like event organizing thing in your blood. And you went to college. When you got into this entrepreneur world, you basically started doing the same thing. You started organizing events, you started attending events, networking, yeah, and all of that.
The university business college system is we try to get you into entry level employee status at like corporations. Like business colleges are funded by Fortune 500 companies. They want you to like churn entry level employees into their system that they can sort of indoctrinate and raise to be middle management. And so throughout that time, I was also being sold the story that like the best job you could get out of college would be to work at a consulting firm like Deloitte or McKinsey. So I was trying to do that. I got interviews with Deloitte and McKinsey. I got interviews with like all the major consulting companies and just couldn't get a job. And so everyone was just talking to me like, aren't you going to do a startup? Like, what are you doing? Isn't like the startup thing your whole thing? And so I started thinking, yeah, okay. And I didn't really have a chance to do the consulting thing because no one would hire me. But then I met, again, through the club. We were putting on our own small business career fair because we thought the career fair was kind of bullshit. Like you had to have so much money to even join the career fair as a company that it was only large corporate companies. So we put on our own small business career fair to bring in like startups and small businesses in town. And one of the guys that wanted to come and hire from that career fair was a founder in Cincinnati, Ohio, looking to hire like his first employee, his COO. And I met with him just to like try to sell him on coming to the career fair. And I left that first meeting thinking, I think I want to take that job. And so we talked some more, and I like negotiated myself into a small amount of equity, not nearly enough equity, and joined that company. And we did that for a few years and did like the accelerator angel funding, eventually got acquired. And so that was like my rocket ship into the world of startups and entrepreneurship, was building that company with him basically from day one. And I'm so glad that's the way that worked out too, because I've, a lot of my friends went the consulting route, and I just watched what their realities looked like. And it seemed way less fun than what I was doing and way more stressful.
Yeah. Because the usual route is that, right? They go consulting, and then after 2-3 years, they quit to follow their dreams or whatever it is. Totally. But you just
such a bizarre
that.
Thing. It's such a bizarre thing to think like, okay, we're building consulting companies off the back of like 22, 23 year olds just out of college. Mm-hmm. Like, why would a company want to hire that person as a consultant? I didn't know anything. I could like do math problems. That was like what I could do as an entry level consultant. Anyway, yeah, the machine of consulting is we hire a small number of people at a high salary. We burn you out. You quit, you've learned a lot, you've made a lot of money. But by that time, a lot of people are also, they have inflated their life costs in alignment with the job. So I, on the other hand, had no money. Yeah. And so I was learning how to live super cheap, which gave me just so much optionality to take more risks and do more things. Again, like I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if I didn't learn to live on like no money.
Yeah. And I also feel like, cause right now I feel like I can overnight, if I have to go to living in a studio or like, you know, on somebody's couch, like I can do it. Totally. Like I have no fear of going back there.
Totally. Been there before. And that's the thing, right? That's like when you don't have the fear, like when you experience something, a lot of times you don't fear it anymore. And so a lot of people haven't had the experience of, oh, a 600 square foot apartment isn't that bad. Actually, there's like way less on your mind because you don't have to manage that much. You don't have to upkeep that much. Like it was a mess, but it was also a small contained mess. And if I had to go back there, like I could do that and it wouldn't hurt me. It wouldn't bother me. It'd be a relief in some ways even. So yeah, I think having those experiences eliminates some of the fears that people have in trying something.
And I agree with you about the consulting business like that. I really think that the whole reason why consulting businesses exist is because like part of my language, I think, because like a lot of people who work in corporate are like little pussies and they can't, there are certain hard jobs that like firing people that they can't do. So they get these outside people to come in and do it.
Totally. Like, or even like diagnose like, that the people are bad because like, I've had friends who like consult for like PepsiCo, huge corporation, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of employees. It's hard to hire good talent at an organization that has to fill that many seats and moves that slowly. That sounds miserable to like work with people who are just kind of clocking in and doing things. So like, I do get that a lot of companies, the larger they get, the average level of talent across the organization reduces. And so bringing in an outside perspective that is smart and sharp can help. But again, then the consultants are also dealing with these same people. And again, it doesn't sound super fun to me.
Yeah. and there's downsides to consultants too, right? Because they do things that they don't really care about the really long term because they're not going to be there 5 years later. So they're not really looking at long term outcomes, right? So
totally.
So you worked at this startup for, like that. Actually, I was going to say that you couldn't have had a better start because you almost got in the ground level. Mm-hmm. You kind of helped build this company from zero to wherever it is. And you didn't really have to take that much of a risk to do it.
Yeah, I didn't feel the weight that the other guy did. Like when he went to bed at night, his head at the pillow, he was really responsible for like everything, including me. And like, I just had this capped downside, huge upside opportunity of if this goes great, that's amazing. If it doesn't go great, I'm not really that worse off. And I've been getting paid something all along the way. So it was like the perfect thing.
So how did you get, did you exit from there? Did you like sell your shares or how did you, what was the next?
It's a pretty insane story, all things considered. We, so the company that we built was in the event ticketing space on the secondary side. So like Ticketmaster is primary ticket sales. It's like the first time it's issued from the team or the artist. That is a primary sale. And then if you resell that on StubHub or whatever, that's a secondary sale. So we built a secondary ticketing marketplace that competed with things like StubHub and Vivid Seats. The thing that we did differently was we allowed people to come to us, and instead of listing a ticket for sale on a marketplace and trying to bring in a third-party buyer, we would buy that ticket from people in site credit immediately. We would value it, we would give you credit, and you could have that in your account and spend that on something else later down the road. So that was an interesting innovation. It was also like complete duct tape and manual risk-taking work by me on the back end. Like I would look at this, I would look at the time left, I'd look at the weather.
Yeah, that
I would
sounds
look
like
at
a
seats.
Huge risk.
Yeah, totally. Like you're taking on inventory. And sometimes we would make like bad offers. We would say like, hey, this event is in 3 hours. I'll give you $5 for this ticket. And people will say no, and that's fine. Then we won't buy it. But yeah, it was very much like a weighted risk effort, but it was great for cash flow because those people, most of our customers, our power users, were people who bought like season tickets for a team, and they were traditionally just getting no value out of a bunch of their tickets. They just didn't use them. And so this was like an immediate way. It was easy to capture value out of something you've already paid for. And we would sell the ticket, get cash, and we would have to hold that liability on our balance sheet. But a lot of times people didn't redeem their credits. My partner, the founder, he had a background in Macy's rewards, like their loyalty section. So he understood that a lot of loyalty points don't even get used. Anyway, that was our innovation. And we got approached by a company that was building dedicated mobile apps for teams. They built like an app for the Washington Redskins and New York Jets, and they wanted to incorporate our technology into the app, or at least that's what they said. Turns out that company was like kind of criminal. And what they actually wanted to do was acquire us so that our revenue boosted their valuation so they could do a bigger deal. It was a mess. And they got sued into oblivion. But for a year, I worked for that company so that I could get my earnout. And after that year, I left.
Got it. And then where did you go after that?
Then I went and worked for a venture-backed healthcare startup. It was at Series C at the time. And I spent about a year there building a new product until they pivoted that company for like the 12th time. And I said, I think I'm just going to go back out on my own. It was really hard for me to go from like a co-founder being at the table for every major conversation to now I had a boss. I was like a second tier leadership member, but there were a bunch of conversations I wasn't privy to. My feedback wasn't taken as seriously. I just had a hard time with it. So I kind of like rage quit one day, didn't have a plan, and had to start freelancing, essentially. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I believed in my own skills and abilities enough that I figured I would figure something out. Started facilitating mastermind groups, doing some freelancing on the side, got a break and did courses for LinkedIn Learning. And that kind of brought me into this world of content. And
can we go back to that? So when you basically decided to quit that job, were you like, did you at some point knew that you were going to go out on your own? Did that happen like instantly? Was that planned? How did that whole process
I would
go?
Say about 9 months into that job, I realized that this was a short-term thing for me and that I wanted to get back out on my own, but I didn't know what that looked like yet. And so I was kind of in this place of, I was showing up every day, I was doing okay work, but I was trying to think through what does my next step look like. we one day had like this all hands on deck leadership meeting where it was basically like, we're almost out of funding. And to get our next round of funding, we're going to pitch this direction. That's where we're getting the best feedback. So we're completely shifting the company in this new direction. Jay, the product you've been spending 8 or 9 months building, we're actually going to kill that. We're not going to do it. You're now going to be working on this new project over here. And it just felt convenient for me to say, I am out. Like at this point, I don't want to
like the final make red this flag.
Yeah. And it was just like, it even felt wrong for me to say, like, I'm going to embed myself in this new project so that I can leave a month or two from now. It just felt like a natural split moment. And so I told him my team, I was leading a fairly large team, engineering and design. But I said, we have about 6 weeks of material, like 6 weeks of work that we need to do to put this product on maintenance mode. I'll stay for 6 weeks. I don't plan to do anything else other than work for myself. And they said, well, actually, if your team is like prepared and knows what to build, you can just do your exit interview and we'll pay you out for 2 weeks. So I went from like in a span of 48 hours, I went from, I think I want to leave my job at some point to I have no job, no plan, but 2 weeks of salary. And I just had to figure it out.
But were you like, were you worried about money or were you like kind of, did you have some runway so that you're like, okay, I know I can last this long as an entrepreneur. And if I don't make it, like, did you have some backup plan?
I quit the job in mid-April. I stopped getting paid late April of 2017. And I told myself, if I don't make any money through June, that's okay. But I need to be generating revenue by July or I'm going to get another job.
So you give a deadline.
Yeah, I gave myself a deadline, which was good. And it was a pretty short deadline. But, you know, inevitably, late May came around. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I doing? What am I even doing? What am I going to do to make money? But I did like this pilot group of the mastermind cohort. I pulled in a couple of website clients. At the time, I was doing like WordPress websites plus automation in MailChimp to help people capture leads and send email sequences, basic stuff. But, and I wasn't a designer. I was just doing like functional things for a company that sold storm doors, you know, like weird stuff. But, it was enough. It paid the bills. I knew exactly how much I needed to pay my bills. And as long as I was doing that, I was kind of happy. I was like, I have full flexibility over my time again. The life of a product manager, which is what I was doing at that healthcare company, extremely stressful and busy and like regimented. I was basically wall to wall meetings every day, all week for a year with that company. To go back out and now have like full flexibility of my time, wake up when I want, work from where I want, talk to who I want. It was heaven. It was awesome. And I remembered like, okay, I am not giving this up again.
Okay. So you're like, this is it. This is my final destination.
Yeah. Like in some form, it was very much like, I just want to have control over my day. I can't imagine having no control over my day, being on a fixed income. Like the trade-off we make in traditional employment is such a bummer. And it's not that different from client work. Like a full-time employment is basically having one very needy client that pays you a poor hourly rate, but is willing to give you health insurance. And we think that health insurance and these benefits is this crazy, amazing, valuable thing, but that's costing the company like $5,000 per year per employee. You know, like if you take your salary plus $5,000 per year, that's not that much compensation, especially when you think about all the hours you're giving up. So I started to realize that pretty early.
Yeah. It's a false sense of safety, I think, a job.
Totally. It's not real. And they can blindside you at any time. And then you're in like a bad spot because, again, like you've probably inflated your, like this sense of safety has inflated your spend. You haven't built up any equity on the side.
You become soft.
Yeah, you get a little soft. You don't have anything to fall back on. You don't even know like how to weaponize your skills in a way that you can like hunt for deals and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. So
the harder path of like figuring out how to even build a full-time salary for yourself, quote unquote, if you want to put it that way, is such a valuable skill forever. Anything in my business could go haywire and go wrong, and I have complete confidence that I would land on my feet tomorrow because I've done the hard thing.
Yeah. That's the hardest part, I think, going from zero to like 100K a year. Like, I think it gets easier from there. 100K to a million gets easier and so on and so on. So where did it go from there? So you started to freelance. You're like, okay, this is, I like this. And then did you continue to grow your freelance business?
What I really wanted to do, I was starting this mastermind program because I had a conversation with a guy. He knew I was well connected from all the stuff I was doing, organizing events around town. And he said, if I had your network, I would facilitate mastermind groups. He was a part of, I want to say like EO, Entrepreneurs Organization or something. But he had seen the value of, if you can get a room of people who are similar and working on something together, like, magic happens. And if you can facilitate that, then you can be paid for that. And I thought I could do that. So I started forming these mastermind groups. And that was really great because effectively that allowed me to scale a high hourly rate across five people at a time. Because like, I'm spending an hour with five people. The program itself wasn't that expensive, but you know, you take their contribution times five per hour, and it was pretty meaningful, and it gave me a lot of time back. So I realized pretty quickly that what I wanted was to not sell my time for money. I didn't actually like doing the freelance work because it mostly sucked. Like, it was work that was
setting a MailChimp.
Yeah. Like, it was like writing copy. And I worked with some bigger and bigger clients. Like, at one point I worked with Atlassian and Ohio State. Mm-hmm. I worked with like one of the biggest auto manufacturers on the planet. And it was fine, but like, what value is that giving me long term? It's giving me the value to sell to another client, I guess, but it just felt like I wasn't building a future for myself. I wasn't actually building on top of anything. And I realized that my real future was building my own projects. And in the world of product management, for me to create a product, I had to talk to a customer, design it in my mind, talk to an engineer, talk to a designer, and then hopefully all of us together could come up with that thing that I wanted to make. Inevitably, there were trade-offs because of feasibility or timelines or budget or this person's opinion over here. But in the world of content, when it came to writing or creating a podcast, I could do whatever I wanted and it could just be me. And that was so amazing to go from, I need to work through people to get the outcome I want, to, I just need to learn skills and I can do whatever I want and make things on my terms without compromising. So
were you making content this whole time?
I had begun in January of the year I quit my job. So 3 months before I quit my job, I had begun writing an email newsletter simply as an exercise to prove to myself that I was creative, because I worked with a coach. He realized I had this limiting belief that I did not think I was a creative person. And that was holding me back from going out on my own or quitting my job, because I thought that I had to be the operator or the integrator for somebody else. And so just as an exercise and to prove to myself that I had ideas, I started writing a daily newsletter, and I did it publicly because that was a forcing function. I have like a crippling fear of failing publicly. So if I told people that they could expect to hear from me every day, that was the forcing function of getting me to do it.
Got it. So that is that kind of how you already had a network, and that's why you were able to launch the mastermind behind that?
Not really. I mean, we're talking like a couple hundred subscribers, maybe. Like, the people that came into the mastermind program, it was very much an effort of me. I spent probably 10 hours a week meeting new people, and you'd call it networking, but it was usually one-to-one. It wasn't like I was going to a networking event and sending business cards. It was like I scheduled a 30 or 60 minute coffee with somebody that we had some shared interest with, and I would talk to them about their project. And if they felt like a good fit for that program, I'd make a note. And, you know, the two or three times per year that I ran that program, I would go through my notes and see who's a good fit. I'd reach out to that person and have a conversation again and say, this seems like it might help you. Let's talk about it. And if it was a good fit, I was pretty good at closing a sale on the phone.
So how did that go from that? Because you have a mastermind kind of product already, and you're growing that. So how did that go from there to like you actually wanting to be a content creator? Because like for me at that point, like I wouldn't immediately connect the dots, be like, okay, I need to start making content. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, so I did the LinkedIn thing. I distinctly remember it was like December of 2017. I got the opportunity for LinkedIn to audition to do a course for LinkedIn Learning. And at the same time, I had a friend who was pitching me on starting a podcast. He was big on listening to podcasts. He knew that I was interested in startups. And he was like, I think we should do a podcast where we talk to startup founders who are not based in San Francisco because we live in Ohio. Mm-hmm. I said, that's interesting. So we did a podcast, an investing, like a startup investing podcast for 3 years. And I loved that. And at the same time, I was still writing my newsletter. We were writing a newsletter for that podcast too. So I was already creating content because I just liked doing it. It felt cool to make stuff and get feedback from people.
And I wasn't really sure where it was going yet. Yeah.
I mean, it was, I hope that it was, but you know, all of this stuff is even now, it hasn't been that long, but these terms, it wasn't spoken about that way then. Like there wasn't as many people talking about like building an audience or like I didn't really understand those words. I just knew if I get more people to subscribe to this, I can probably sell products and make this mastermind thing easier. But I didn't have all the language for the stuff yet. I just like I was fascinated by the business model without really understanding the ins and outs of it yet. But I started to realize that I enjoyed working with creative people more than I enjoyed working with startup founders because creative people are inherently more enthusiastic. They're more passionate. They were just so much more fun. They were compulsively doing things. Whereas in the startup world, there were a lot of people who wanted the identity of being a founder. And so they would like force some shitty idea that they didn't even like into existence. And I just knew like this thing won't exist 6 months from now. I can't get excited about it. I can't get excited about something that I know won't exist 6 months from now because you don't care. Other people don't care. It's a bad idea. Whereas the people who were genuinely enthusiastic about whatever it was, even if it was like doing art on Instagram, I was so much more interested in. So I moved more and more in that direction because I had this bifurcated focus at the time of creative people, creative work, and startup stuff. And slowly I just kind of killed the startup content and went all in on the creative individual, started to understand the evolving world of the creator economy. And in my own attempt to really understand the business model and how this all works, that became like the thing that I was writing about because I was like studying it and then I'd write about it and I'd study it and I'd write about it. And that just kind of began, you know, this meta creator nature of what I do now, which is being very thoughtful, very analytical, looking for evidence and data, and then showing people here's what's working for content creators over here and this content creator. And here's how you should think about this if you're building your own content business.
Do you think that's something that is also kind of like in your personality, like that analytical, like like trying to figure out how this kind of like because I feel like not everybody does that, right? I think there are people who are just like, okay, I just let it out of me. Versus people who are more like analyzing it.
So this goes back to that issue I was having in my own head in 2017. I was very good at operationalizing things, but I just didn't think I was very creative. So for me to get, but like I aspired to be creative, like Julie Cameron would call it like the shadow artist in the artist way, right? Mm-hmm. Like I had this strong shadow artist where that's the life that I wanted, but I felt like I couldn't. So I was just like, I had to study people and be analytical to understand how creative things work. A lot of people who are creative and artistic, it's very intuitive. It's very like feel based, but I didn't have that muscle for a long time. I had to study and I had to like understand theory and I wanted to see data. We didn't talk about this, but my entire family are teachers, mostly like K-12. And so like, I'd say teaching is in my blood as well. It's funny because when I went to college, I said, I don't know what I want to do, but the one thing I know I don't want to do is teach. And here I am, like basically my life is teaching. But you like to teach something, you have to understand it. When you try to teach something, but you don't truly understand it, it becomes really obvious really fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when did this whole, so you created a community, which then you sold to Petflin.
Yes.
So when did this happen? Like while this whole thing is going on, or before you started the creator side?
So the mastermind program, this was a business called Unreal Collective. That's what I call the mastermind program. And beginning in 2017, we were using Zoom and Slack. Which sounds obvious and like, of course you were, but at the time I had to teach people how to install Zoom. I had to explain why we were using Zoom. Like Zoom wasn't a thing and Slack wasn't a thing for community either, but I just wanted people to be able to communicate with each other when we weren't live on the phone. So after running this program for about 4 years, we had this Slack community of about 130 people in there. And one of the people who had gone through the program was a guy named Matt Gartland. And he had built an agency in Columbus, Ohio, and that agency helped Pat Flynn launch one of his books. And so after a bunch of successful projects together, Pat bought Matt's agency. They like brought the two together, and that became Pat's in-house creative team. In 2020, the world started exploding with this new virus, and Matt and Pat decided that they were going to go all in on digital community. It was something that they'd been thinking about, but they wanted to fast track that because now suddenly they were doing like this event called FlynnCon. In-person events weren't going to happen. Let's do online community. Matt had experienced my program. He had experienced my Slack community. He brought me in as a consultant to help them design their new community, which is built on this brand new tool that was in beta, private beta, called Circle. So those two are early investors, advisors to the company. I got to see Circle literally from like ground zero also. We started building SPI Pro. We launched it. We hired a community manager, and it was really successful. Like we launched with almost 600 members the day that we turned it on. And
that's awesome.
It made them take community even more seriously.
They have like the biggest community on Circle.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. And they do a really good job with it. And they saw the opportunity like immediately, because now this business that was primarily course-based and one-time purchases had recurring revenue, monthly and annual recurring revenue. So they were over the moon, and Matt asked if he could hire me to lead the community team. And I said no, because I had too much going on. It's like, well, I've got the mastermind program that I'm doing. I'm creating my own content. I want to keep creating my own content. So I just don't have any time to like take a job, even a part-time job. And he said, well, how about we buy the mastermind program and that community, and we let you continue creating content on the side? And that was a pretty good deal, because I actually wanted to conclude that chapter, that program. This gave me a really nice story, to be honest, to wrap this up and say, this is over. It's being absorbed into SPI Pro. I gave those members a year of free access to the community if they wanted it. And I was a full-time employee working 30 hours a week. So I had benefits, I had a salary, and still a good amount of time to do my content on the side. And that year was a transformative year for my business.
That's awesome. I forgot what they call that, but like they acquired your company because they wanted to hire you.
Acquire, basically. Yeah, essentially.
Yeah. So yeah, it sounds like every step of the way your life has been kind of like, it's like kind of perfect, because people always talk about like taking risks, like as if it was like you're supposed to take this outrageous risk, but you took risks, but you did it in a smart way. Where you weren't like putting yourself in a like, you know, total like jeopardy, or
there's this term in investing called asymmetric risk or asymmetric bets. Mm-hmm. It's this idea that you can find opportunities that have high upside potential, but also like a pretty high floor. Like if it goes badly, it's not going to go that badly. If it goes well, it can go really well. So I think I'm actually pretty risk averse. I'm pretty conservative, but I will identify and take good bets that have high upside potential but low downside risk.
Yeah. And I think that's where most people fail. If I look at most people, it's not because they fail in a huge way. It's because they miss on good opportunities that came along the way or something like that. Yeah.
Or a lot of times people overestimate the upside and underestimate the downside. So a lot of people will take asymmetric risks in the wrong way, where they like take too much risk for not a very high return. But also if it goes badly, like bad things can happen.
Yeah. So from there till now, can you kind of talk about like where you're at now from there? And then kind of what your plan is for the future?
So I remember in August of 2020, I moved my own list from MailChimp to ConvertKit. And I know I imported about 1,800 email subscribers. I started my podcast in March of 2020, so around the same time. And to today, if we fast forward, the podcast hasn't grown as much as everything else. Podcasts are so hard to grow. But the podcast has done about 2 million downloads all time. The email list is just about 60,000 subscribers. The YouTube channel just crossed 80,000 subscribers today, and it's less than 2 years old. So things have grown pretty well. I know the first
I just want
year
people
that
to understand, like, this is not a norm. Like, I see a lot of creators and stuff like that, but the rate that you're growing in this past couple of years is definitely above average, I would say, from what I've seen.
I would agree. It's above average, but you know, we're always moving goalposts. We're always looking at somebody else who's doing things faster and saying, why not me? And I remember so 2020, the year that I did consulting work with Matt and Pat and was doing my own thing, I was still doing my own thing that year, but I started working with Matt and Pat in a consulting capacity. 2020 was the first year that I broke six figures as a business owner. It was barely crossed $100,000. 2021, I eliminated all service work because I had a salary at Smart Passive Income. 2021, not counting my salary, the business generated $151,000, I want to say. So like 50% more passively, revenue, and none of it was service-based. And then things have been on a good trajectory since then. I had a year that was about $300,000, and last year was 565, and this year we're on pace for about 700-750 without factoring in new product launches. So things are going quickly. I'm very, very fortunate.
And that's not like we're kind of in the beginning of the year, so anything can happen.
Best Q1,
maybe it'll be
so
5 million.
But we'll see. I would love for it to be higher. I brought my wife onto the team full time this year, so now we're partners in life and in the business. Wow.
An easy decision, or was it like?
We took it seriously. At an event in June of last year at ConvertKit's Craft and Commerce event, there were a couple of talks from folks who have done a good job of scaling, of hiring and things. And it was a wake-up call for me that I was reaching the limits of what I could do as an individual. And if I was going to hire, I knew my wife's skill set. I know what she's great at. I've seen her work. The ideal scenario is instead of hiring somebody else to be a partner in the business or a high paid employee, like business money comes into the business and it flows right back to our family. So we talked about it. She gave her boss, her team, like 6 months notice. She filled out the whole year so I could kind of prepare the business financially to take on more expense. And so far it's been great. So easy decision. Like, I want to do this, but we had to think about it because like it has ramifications on family life. It has ramifications on the relationship. Like, how will we handle certain things? We had a lot of conversations. We had to work through a lot of stuff, but couldn't have asked.
And I'm sure you'll bump into more issues as you go on and figure it out.
Of course. We're recording this early April. We're having our first child in the middle of July. And we both want to take parental leave. So like, what's that going to look like? We're figuring that out. But it's cool. Like having a family business and having total work-life integration understanding that like we want to enjoy the life part of that equation, I think is like the ultimate life you can build for yourself. It's awesome. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. There's a lot of stuff to work through.
I work with my wife, and I think and we've been working together for like over 10 years.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So Gigi is my wife. And I think one of the things that, for us, it was helpful, because I think when you and your spouse work together, like now it's literally obviously you also have like a real baby in real life, but this is also your baby, right? So
yeah,
there's something about that bonds you together.
Yeah.
Like something about like going through the struggle of building this thing together that like bonds you. Yeah.
So and I think
for us, it helped their relationship. Yeah.
It also creates like a new awareness of what I'm doing all the time. You know, like in the past, when she has her job and I have my job, like we know we're both working on things, but we don't actually have like a full view of like what each other are doing, how much we're doing, what we're capable of. So I think for her, it's been eye-opening just to see how much happens in the business that I'm doing. And it's rewarding for her to be able to help take things off my plate and see that frees me up to do some cool things. Yeah. Everything that she's taken off my plate, she has leveled up and made better for the business, which has been really awesome.
Oh, that's amazing.
It
sounds like a good, you guys have like a good balance. So where do you go from here? What's like, what are your plans for, or do you just kind of go where the wind takes you?
I have to fight the urge. There's something about entrepreneurship and how challenging it is in the beginning that sort of trains you to think that things have to be hard to be worth it. And so when things start to feel easy and you have like some level of success, there's a part of you that like gets bored and wants to do something new and like just burn down everything you've done to start a new challenge. But I feel like I'm just entering the phase in the business now where like things are compounding and really like there's a lot that can be gained in a shorter period of time. And I really want to just focus on that opportunity despite having like more ideas and things that I want to do. So I want to continue to build Creator Science into one of the best, most reputable, most helpful media companies to help people become professional creators. And that's really all that matters. If I do a good job doing that, then this could be a pretty big business.
And then you do it like primarily in a very analytical way. Like you look at what people are doing, you analyze.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, it's through the lens of there are a lot of people who make content because they think it's fun to see numbers go up, like followers and views and whatever. But there are also a lot of people making content that get a lot of attention and views and things that aren't reaping any financial benefit. So I really want to help people from the beginning see a financial return, like get compensated for all this work that they're doing.
I feel like that's going to become like a kind of big thing in the future where people realize that not all creators make money, and like how do you do it in a sustainable way? So kind of to wrap this up, I want to ask you, what would you say? Like, so for me, before, like I was saying, for me, this is a story for me. Like, I think we all live life with a certain belief about the world, right? And some of those beliefs are true, some of them are false, but we believe them and then we clash with the reality. Like, so for example, when I was really young, I always like, oh, if I like a girl, then I have to be like, you know, I have to shower them with love and flowers. But then it wasn't until later I realized like, okay, the reality is different. Actually, girls are not going to like you when you're too like obsessed over them or something like that, right? So there's so many little things like that throughout my life where I had certain false belief and I had to clash with reality and then learn, right? And I think that moment of clash is where the story happens, because this is where the inner transformation happens. And some of those, obviously we have a lot of little things like that in our lives, but there are some major things, clashes that happen in our life's moments that I feel like kind of is, we call them epiphanies or something like that, right? Where it shifts like the way we look at the world or something like that. And it really defines kind of who we are. Like for me, one of those big ones was about being vulnerable, right? Like I always thought that I had to have a wall up between me and my client. But I actually like found that by letting that wall down, it's, you know, things like that. That was like a big realization for me. So I wanted to ask you, are there any few life lessons that you've learned that are like kind of core to you, you know, that makes you who you are? And how did you learn those lessons? Like what were some of things that happened in your life that made you learn those lessons?
Man, I feel like these happen all the time. And they seem like kind of small and inconsequential as they're happening. And we've mentioned a couple of them already, like that conversation where I learned that entrepreneurship was a thing. Completely world-breaking, unbelievable life change. When I realized that content was a product and software wasn't the only, you know, quote-unquote product there was out there to build a business on. Life-changing. I think the meta of this all is something I think about a lot. I really like, I like watching documentaries and TV shows about outlier performances, things like, Hard Knocks on HBO, watching NFL players do that, or anything that like looks into a peak athlete's, process. Or this is going to seem like a weird comparative example. I like watching things like Anna Delvey and the WeWork implosion or the Theranos stuff. We're like fascinated by this stuff. And when it gets down to it, it's because these people are achieving and doing crazy things that we can hardly imagine ourselves doing. And the through line, whether you're a peak athlete that people love or someone that is like borderline criminal doing insane things, the through line is that these people achieve things because they believe that they can. Like really the only thing that you need is just belief that you can do it. Because when you have belief, when you're optimistic and you believe that you can achieve this thing, you don't think that it's just going to happen by accident or magic. Mm-hmm. You're going to take the steps that you have to do to put yourself in a position for it to be real. But I do think that that belief is the tension that forces you to do the things that you have to do to realize the future that you think you can have. And a lot of people are very pessimistic. And I think that just lets them off the hook from trying and doing stuff. So I have like no room for pessimists in my life. Like I just reject it. And I am optimistic about just about anything that I want, because more times than not.
Have you always been like that though? Or no. is that something you developed, I think you think of?
Developed over time. And it's like, it gets easier when you're in environments and surrounded by people who feel the same way. When you're around pessimistic people, you tend to be pessimistic. But when you start to be around other people who are achieving crazy things, like it's because they have this belief. And whether they say it actively or whether you just see it in their behavior, they think they're going to achieve a thing. And their belief in that is the precursor to the actions that make it true. And you just realize, the stuff that I want, I can do. I just have to believe and then.
Yeah. So maybe that's kind of like your message for the world. Like what you see is like a lot of people just don't believe that they can. Cause you know, like as you're saying that, what it reminded me of is like, you know, I worked in IT for the first half of my career, and I used to like fix computers, and that's like a service type of, you know, career, right? These are people in service, right? So I always consider myself like a service person. So like if somebody's computer breaks at the office, I'll go fix it. And I'm like the maintenance guy or something like that, right? And I would look at the regular employees sitting in the desk doing work, and I'm like, that's like the real office job. What I'm doing is not like a real office job. I'm just the maintenance guy. That's kind of how I always looked at it, right? Not knowing that actually I can do that job too.
Totally.
Do you know what I mean?
And perception is reality. Your beliefs, whatever you believe, is going to be true. Like if you believe that you can't do a thing, that's also going to be true. So like, why not choose the one that serves you?
Mm-hmm. Awesome message. I love that. And so I think I want to first thank you for sharing all of your stories so openly with us. Yeah, so let's do kind of a last plug before we end things. Where do people find you? Do you still have your own community that people can join, like a membership?
And I do.
So
yeah.
where can they join that?
Yeah, we have a membership called The Lab, and it's for professional creators. So if you're doing this full time and you want to be around other people that are doing this full time, that's a great place for you to plug in. But generally, if you like this, check out the Creator Science Podcast in audio or on YouTube. And if you want to follow me on any of the socials, it's just Jay Klaus. I'm hard to miss.
Yeah, definitely check out Jay's YouTube channel, which is amazing. Like there was that one episode with that girl, that tick girl from TikTok.
Yeah, Jenny.
Yeah. And it was like when I was watching that episode, that was kind of like, I feel like it really defines what your brand is all about.
Yes,
because the way she breaks down like the science of how, totally. I was like, holy
totally.
Shit.
I love data. I love evidence-backed stuff. Like a lot of people have opinions, but I want to see the data. Like show me proof.
Yeah.
And that's what we try to
say. And you were so happy to see that she just came with data after data. Yeah.
It was amazing. That was awesome. It was the best.
Well, thank you so much, Jay, for taking the time to join us. Definitely go check out Jay's YouTube podcast as well as the lab, which is his community. I'll see you all next week, and cheers. Bye, everyone.
Thanks, son.